Welcome to Tales of History and Imagination. Eccentric Tales from History by Simone Whitlow. Hello all, welcome. The next two tales over the next 4 weeks will be short tales taken from older blog posts, from the vaults, as we like to say. Let's jump into today's tale. In 1885, an anxious father of five unmarried daughters wrote a letter to the Pittsburgh Dispatch, desperate for advice. The man was worried about how his girls would cope out in the big bad world without men to look after them. Their columnist, Erasmus Wilson, replied in an editorial piece entitled, "What Girls Are Good For." Wilson did not think girls were good for terribly much. In his diatribe, Wilson decried working women as, quote, a monstrosity, end quote. He stated the only place for a woman was in the home. He lambasted parents of working women for allowing them to enter the workplace, and suggested perhaps America should follow China's two-millennia-long practice of some parents drowning female babies. If you can imagine that even in 1885, such an exhibit of he-man woman-hating misogyny would get some heat, well, you'd be correct. A mountain of letters of complaint to the editor came flooding in. One in particular, an anonymous piece signed Lonely Orphan Girl, stood out for its remarkably direct and persuasive use of language. The letter never got published, but so impressed managing editor George Madden that he wrote an open letter inviting the writer to come see him. The next day, a 20-year-old woman named Elizabeth Cochran, a former trainee teacher at Indiana Teachers College, who dropped out to help her mother run a boarding house, arrived at the office. Madden offered her a job on the spot as a reporter, which she took unhesitatingly. Cochran took on the nom de plume Nellie Bly, a name she borrowed from a minstrel song written by the father of American music, Stephen Foster. Bly wrote for the Pittsburgh Dispatch for 7 years, writing mostly on fashion, high society, gardening, and the like. But she also covered the lives of working women, the poor of Pittsburgh, and for some time, official corruption and wealth inequality in Mexico. Looking for bigger opportunities, she moved to New York in 1887. That year, she approached Joseph Pulitzer of the New York World, wanting to report on the lives of poor immigrants in the Big Apple. While the New York World was not all that interested in that story, they did have a challenging job for Nellie. Infiltrate the remote, secretive Blackwell Island insane asylum. As she would do to a number of big challenges in her life, Bly took up the challenge without a moment's thought. On 22nd September 1887, Nellie Bly came up with a plan to get herself committed, with the least amount of collateral damage. Under the guise of a young out-of-towner looking for work, she booked herself into a boarding house for working women. Then began to act one part paranoid, one part clinically depressed, a third part retrograde amnesiac. She, in turns, acted insane, till the boarding house owners called two police officers to come over and take her away. The police arrived, took her back to the station. Then, before the kindly Judge Duffy, it took quite some convincing to send Nellie to Bellevue Hospital for examination. At Bellevue, Nellie easily convinced the doctors she was, quote, positively demented, end quote, and beyond help. After a very short examination by a couple of what then passed for expert doctors at the time, she was soon sent off to the asylum. In her 10 days in the asylum, she uncovered a litany of horrors and mistreatment. First, there was the ubiquitous chill. The asylum was freezing cold, and the staff refused to turn on the heat or provide sufficient clothing to keep inmates warm. Secondly, the days were full of long hours of sitting around in a main room, an unadorned and overcrowded room, on backless benches, 6 people crammed into 5 spaces. One dare not speak or move around for fear of abuse from the staff. Third, the food sounded absolutely horrific. Bly describes on their arrival to the island the sickening stench coming from one particular building, quote, "We passed one low building and the stench was so horrible that I was compelled to hold my breath." This turned out to be the kitchen, back to the quote. She smiled at the signboard at the end of the walk, visitors are not allowed onto this road. I don't think a sign would be necessary if they once tried the road, especially on a warm day. End quote. She goes on to describe inedible food, soups that are little more than water, blackened, possibly mouldy bread, rancid butter. It was also very clear the inmates were not bathed nearly enough. When they were bathed in ice-cold water, were scrubbed by the same few flannels, and were dried off with the same few towels. This included inmates with untreated sores. The inmates were also dressed in the same clothes for up to a month at a time. Adding to the horrors, sleep for any decent length of time was out of question. The noise of the nurses moving up and down the hallways at night reverberated like they were in an echo chamber. If that didn't wake you, then the nurses opening the door to look in, having to turn a heavy, noisy lock each time to do so, was bound to wake you up. Speaking of those doors, they were death traps, should a fire break out. All individually locked, with no safety to unlock all the rooms at once. Should an emergency occur, there was no chance anyone would get out alive. Bly comments that many of the women incarcerated are as sane as herself. Certainly in some of her conversations, it does seem some of the inmates were suffering from, at very most, depression or anxiety. Some you question if they are suffering from anything at all besides the effects of being trapped in a horror mental asylum. Bly mentions a French inmate, Josephine Desperoux, who appeared to have been locked up over a misunderstanding and who did not have enough English to defend herself. Sarah Fishbaum, who was locked away on the word of her husband, she'd either flirted with or had an affair with another man. She mentions a German maid by the name of Margaret, who was locked up after getting in a fight with co-workers, who had deliberately messed up a floor she'd spent hours scrubbing. What does seem pretty obvious is both the unprofessionalism of the doctors. One gossiping with a nurse in front of Bly, asking if she'd read the newspaper articles on Bly's case, and of their great disinterest in helping, or even properly assessing, the inmates. The nurses were disturbing in other ways. Bly reported on their propensity to act with violence towards the inmates. She mentions one case where an insane woman was dropped off at the island, and the nurses greeted her with a beating. When a doctor noticed the inmate's black eye, the nurses claimed the beating must have happened before the inmate arrived. Then there was a case of Mrs. Cotter. To quote Bly, quote, "One of the patients, Mrs. Cotter, a pretty, delicate woman, one day thought she saw her husband coming up the walk. She left the line in which she was marching and ran to meet him. For this act, she was sent to the retreat," she afterwards said, now quoting a quote. "The remembrance of that is enough to make me mad. For crying, the nurses beat me with a broom handle and jumped on me, injuring me internally, so that I shall never get over it. Then they tied my hands and feet, and throwing a sheet over my head, twisted it tightly around my throat, so that I could not scream, and thus put me in a bathtub filled with cold water. They held me under until I gave up every hope and became senseless." End quote. 10 days later, she was rescued by her colleagues of the New York World. She recorded her experiences of Blackwell Island in a 6-part expose, which would later be compiled into a book, 10 Days in a Madhouse. The uproar over the treatment of the inmates led to a grand jury investigation, which led to a massive overhaul of the asylum. Bly went on to write several similar exposés in her career, taking down sweatshops, corruption in jails, bribery from lobbyists. Though perhaps today she's best known for taking on the challenge of following in the footsteps of Jules Verne's Phileas Fogg. She documented her circumnavigation of the globe in just 72 days. Nellie Bly retired from journalism in 1895, after marrying the wealthy industrialist Robert Seaman. When Seaman died in 1903, she took the reins of his factory, but would return to journalism in 1920. Elizabeth Cochrane, known to the world as Nellie Bly, star investigative reporter, passed on from pneumonia January 27, 1922. Thanks for listening. This has been Tales of History and Imagination. All episodes written by me, Simone Whitlow. Produced and all music, yours truly. visit the blog historyandimagination.com. Links to social media and liner notes. We have a Facebook and a Twitter, even a Pinterest. We also have a Patreon if you wish to help support the show and keep it going. If you have enjoyed the show, please leave a positive review. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time for more tales of history and imagination.